Thank you, Marnie, and hello, everybody, from all the wonderful myriad places that you're calling in from Helsinki and Spain and Pennsylvania and Dakar, Senegal, which I actually have been before teaching there for the UN, Mexico and Maine, Florida and the UK and many other places around the world. What I love about Sangha Live is the international nature of the community. Being from England myself, and I have a very strong affinity with both England and Europe, and but now living over here in California. And right now, as Mani mentioned, I'm on retreat in Bolinas, which is a little coastal funky town, sticking out into the Pacific Ocean. It's unceded coastal Miwok land, and I'm out here doing my own nature retreat and retreat. So, as Mani mentioned, most of my time these days in my writing and in my own practice and teaching and leading retreats and teacher trainings is focused on nature-based mindfulness practice, meditation, retreats. And so I thought I would share a little about that, partly since my new book just came out, A Field Guide to Nature Meditation, which has a lot of nature-based practices, which you might enjoy. So without further ado, let us sit together. I notice some of you are sitting inside, some of you are sitting outside. If you have the opportunity to be outside, wonderful, or at least by a window. If you can turn your videos on, at least just for a moment, so I can get to see who you are. I recognize some names, but I more recognize faces than names, given the amount of teaching that I do, to remember names. And yes, there's some familiar faces from near and far. So, and I'm also aware it's winter, and so I'm teaching about nature practice, and it can be cold. I was supposed to be in the mountains, but it was going to be about minus 15 up where I was going to go today out in the daytime, minus 15 centigrade. And I thought, oh, I'll practice out on the California coast instead and get more time outside. But yeah, so whether you're sitting indoors or outdoors or some reference to the outdoors, I'm aware that probably for many of you in Europe, it's already dark, nighttime. So, but nature is everywhere. We are nature. And so we can still explore meditation through sensory awareness and attuning to the senses as a doorway, window, connection to the more than human world, to the landscapes around us. So let's sit together. Wherever you are taking your seat, whatever particular part of the earth, indoors or outdoors. So, taking some moments to shift your attention away from the screen and find a suitable meditation posture that can be comfortable, easeful, upright, relaxed. And wherever you're taking your seat, know that you're sitting on the earth. You are of the earth, being held by the earth, sitting in this particular place. And the weight of your body pulled to the earth through gravity is somehow registered on the earth. Sensing yourself as part of the earth's moving surface, sitting on earth. And so feeling the impression of the earth through your feet and legs and sit bones. like a stone resting on the ground, body resting on the earth. Aware of the sensory contact of touch, body, skin, touching the ground, touching the chair, floor, but all always touching earth in some form or other, indoors or outdoors. Aware of your sensory nature, aware of the sensory quality of body, all the sensations of aliveness, energy, touch, pressure, tingling, vibration. Even in stillness, the body is a field of sensation, ebbing and flowing. We have all the ways the body is in connection with the environment around you, and the skin registering sensations and touch of the air, awareness of the fire element, aware of warmth, coolness, if you're outside, there may be an awareness of breeze, wind. So although we're attuning to this particular body, this body is always in relationship through the senses. In the same way as you bring awareness to breathing, physical body, breathing itself, bringing us into intimate awareness, connection to the air element. Sensing how the air element moves through us, Nose. Within is exhaled. Each inhale, breathing in oxygen released from trees, grasses, plants, plankton. Each exhale, exhaling carbon dioxide reabsorbed at some point by plant life, forests, oceans.
On rassemble toutes ces affaires, on les rendra plus tard. Bien sûr.
Elles accueillent parfois 50 à 100 blessés.
And in the same way, sounds appear and disappear. Internal sounds, external sounds, sounds of nature, sounds of people, mechanical sounds. Now the ears are a portal to the sensory world around us. Awareness of sound and its vibration can dissolve the sense of outer and inner. The sound vibration being known. And we tune with mindful awareness to sensory flow of experience, sensation, touch, breeze of air, of sound, of smell, of breath. You may notice at times what qualities may be evoked. We hear the sound of the breeze, or rain, or wind, sounds of birdsong. Notice what arises in the heart, in the mind. Seeing how we're always in relationship, experience always interdependent with environment around us. And so continuing to sit in this way, grounded in the body, aware of sensation, the senses. Sitting with an open quality of awareness is present to whatever sense experience is most predominant in the moment. Seeing how that sensory field of experience is constantly in ebbing and flowing. Abiding in awareness. Present, receptive, awake to the sensory field of experience. And if the attention is spacey, scattered, orienting the attention to a particular aspect of the sensory experience, the movement of sounds, flow of breath, the ebb and flow of sensations in the body. Continuing to sit with an open awareness, present to this sensory flow of experience. last few minutes of the sitting. And where the attention may have roamed, take a new moment to reestablish mindful awareness here, present, tuned to the body and sensations, to the senses, and the sensory world around you. Sensing how the body and senses are always a doorway to connection with the immediacy of life all around. And in these final minutes, so if you wish to include awareness of seeing, gently opening the eyes, especially if you're outside or have some awareness, visual field of the natural world. And sensing how the eyes are also this doorway, this conduit to the world around us. And stay abiding in the receptive quality of awareness, just receiving through the eyes in the same way you receive through the ears and the skin. And bringing your practice to a close. Just noticing how you transition from meditation to post-meditation, from stillness to movement, from perhaps a more interior orientation to more inclusive orientation. I hope you're enjoying the serenade of the house finches. Could you hear the bird sounds from no? Oh, sometimes Zoom has too much compression going on, so it doesn't hear the background sounds. Let me see if I can, yeah. All right, I'm going to change that, and hopefully the house finch will serenade. I was kind of blissing out in this. The house finch is a bit like, well, it reminds me of the robin's song in England where I grew up. It's beautiful, long, lots of different melodies and quite complex vocalization. And so looks like some of you had other birds at your window there, chickadees, titmice. Anyhow, I will invite the birds to come close so that you can hear their song. Which, you know, dovetails into really what I'd like to talk about today. And which is about the exploration of sensory awareness. And how that can be a beautiful support in our meditation, in our Dhamma practice, in life. We are animals, we are sensory beings, but we often forget that. We spend up to 95% of our time indoors now. We spend up to 12 hours looking at a screen, and our animal nature is receding. It's a line from John O'Donohue. May we learn to return and rest in the beauty of our animal being. Learn to lean low, leave our locked minds, and with freed senses, feel the earth breathing with us. May we slip frequently into the feel of the wild and let the clear silence of our animal being cleanse our heart. May we walk upon the earth with all their confidence and clear-eyed stillness, so our minds might be baptized in the name of the wind and the light and the rain. So when I take people outside, which I do all the time, probably almost every week in some form or other, people will often report, as somebody did recently, where they said, why did it take me so long to take my meditation practice outside? Why would I sit indoors when I can sit with the feel of the breeze and the warmth of the sun and the scent of blossom and the sound of returning wintering birds? And I know when I started meditating in England back in the 80s, and I remember for the first time meditating on my own by a pond in the woods in Sussex, where my parents were living in the south, and just felt that profound quality of stillness and calm and ease and connection. And it seemed so obvious, like, of course one can take one's meditation outdoors and actually feel the profound support and aliveness and sensory engagement when we're outdoors. When we're indoors, we build houses for good reasons to keep the elements and extremes and bugs and rain and all of that out, which is, you know, necessary. And yet we also deprive ourselves of we deprive that animal nature, our sensory nature, from the aliveness and the stimulation that naturally comes from being outdoors. And when we go outside, it's the title of one of my first books, Awaken the Wild, is Mindfulness in Nature as a Path of Self-Discovery. And I put that subtitle in because being outdoors reflects our nature. We go outside and we can feel a sense of being at home. There's a homecoming, there's a welcoming. And it reflects so many dimensions of our nature, that we are the earth, we are of the earth, connected, rooted, not a mistake, at home. And so going outside, particularly with a contemplative awareness, we begin to restitch that thread of connection to place, to earth, to home. We start to feel, as my friend Wes Niskett talks about, we feel into our nature, which is, when someone asks him where he's from, he says, I'm an earthling. First and foremost. Or as one of the great outdoor explorers here, John Muir, wrote, climb the mountains, get their good tidings. As sunshine flows into the trees, the wind will blow their freshness into you and storms their energy, while cares will drop off you like falling leaves. So when I came to the States, I very much took my meditation practice outside, my retreats outside, my personal retreats, backpacking retreats, and then started teaching outside. At some point realized that what I was doing was really just very much in the spirit of the Buddha, and what people have done for thousands of years, which is take their meditation. There wasn't an outside. The Buddha lived in the forest, taught in the forest, was born in the forest, died under the forest, woke up under the trees, under the sal trees. And so, and he would encourage his nuns and monks to go and practice. He said, there are the trees, there are the roots of trees. Go meditate there. Seek solace in the forest, lest you regret it later. So he said, go to a tree, go to the root of a tree, which, and if you haven't done that, you should try it. Find an old tree, an oak tree, a beech tree, pine tree, whatever it is. Sit at the root of a tree with your back to it and feel the presence of the supportive presence of that tree. And so people for thousands of years in the Himalayas and in the mountains of Japan and China and in the forests of Southeast Asia, people know this. They go to the forest, they go to the jungles, they go to the mountains, as you may do, to both feel that aliveness, that sensory awareness that we're exploring, connection. And also because it's a place that we can learn so much from the perennial wisdom of the natural world. A great line from poet Kabir, who said, when the eyes and the ears are awake, when the eyes and the ears are awake, which means when we're present, even the leaves on the trees read like pages from the scriptures. So I'm out here on the ocean. When the eyes and the ears are awake, even the rolling surf of the Pacific Ocean or the sound of morning song or the leaves dropping in fall, they read like pages from the scriptures, as in they are teaching us so much about life, about reality, about wisdom, about letting go. And so whenever the weather is supportive for you, I'm going to invite you to bring your awareness practice, mindfulness practice, outdoors, as you may do already formally, like in a sitting meditation or walking meditation, or just all the time that you might spend outdoors in your garden, taking your dog for a walk, gazing at the night sky, watching a sunset. There are many ways that we can use that time and see how that time is profoundly supportive of well-being, of wisdom, of clarity, joy. So I'll talk a little bit about some of the different ways to do that. So, I'm partly going to touch on the four foundations, because the four foundations of mindfulness, which is kind of like the bedrock of mindfulness teaching, is also beautifully illuminated when we go outside. So mindfulness is an embodied practice. And when we go outside, that embodiment wakes up. As I said, we feel our animal nature. We feel the touch of the earth and on the ground. We feel the breeze on our skin. We feel the warm sunlight. We feel the moisture of the air where I am here, out here on the ocean. Right? So our body wakes up, our senses wake up, our animal body wakes up. Partly because the sensory environment is alive, unlike the sort of staticness of our indoor life. And so that aliveness calls our attention. Right? Our attention moves partly to what's arising, what's changing, what's dynamic. And the outdoor landscape is always dynamic. Even in the stillness of winter, there's a dynamism in it. And so as we spend time outside, our senses start to become more acute. Our sense of smell starts to become more sensitive. We're more aware of sounds, partly because we also need to take care of where we are and what's around us. And so that hearing becomes more acute. But what's most, I think, fundamental is that Our attention is always being allured, often by beauty, by color, by light, by movement. I was walking along the beach yesterday, this very kind of pebbly, rocky beach, and I looked up and there was a red-tailed hawk, and my favorite species in the world. And red-tailed hawks have this amazing gift, as some other hawks do. Everything was a good 20 mile an hour wind. And just hovering on the cliff, above the cliff, just perfectly still for at least 5 or 10 minutes while it was tracking its prey, probably a mouse or a mole. And did I need to practice being mindful in that moment? No, I'm just riveted with presence. And curiosity, and my attention is rapt, R-A-P-T, like raptor. Maybe that was where that word comes from. Or I'm walking, and I'm walking up the little stream bed, and there's a grove of eucalyptus trees, and I smell that pungent scent of eucalyptus and also the bay trees here. Or I'm noticing the light on the water, of the changing surface of the water. Right? And our attention is naturally drawn into the present. One of the reasons why meditation indoors, eyes closed, can be challenging, say if you're focusing on breath, and the breath, you know, sometimes interesting, sometimes boring, sometimes neutral. And because of that range of stimulus, our attention will wander because it doesn't hold the attention. When we have a broader range of sensory stimuli, our attention is much more likely to just naturally relax and abide here. I was doing my meditation this morning, and eyes open, and just as I was teaching today, just open sensory awareness. And very easy for the attention just to rest because of the just tracking all the various movements of sense experience. Light, breeze, smell, touch, warmth, coolness, sound. A yogi on a retreat said, it feels like I'm cheating when I'm doing my meditation outside because it's so much easier to sort of abide in the present. There's less the power of the mind. The mind has such a strong pull, thoughts, ideas, images, plans. But when the attention is grounded in our sensory nature, in a sensory environment, we can actually, there's so much more to just rest with ease in the present. And what I notice about cultivating awareness outside is it calls forth a lot of other related, supported qualities of mindfulness. For example, like curiosity. It's hard not to be curious when you're outdoors. Nature is unceasingly mysterious and full of complexity and diversity and wonder. And so it draws our curiosity. It also invites a quality of receptivity, particularly with something like sounds. And just letting the sensory world come to us, as it were, move through us. It also teaches a lot about other qualities like steadiness, spaciousness, equanimity. Right? We go outside often, as it was yesterday, it was cold, it was windy. And, you know, it invites us to, can we find a steadiness and stillness, a presence with those changing conditions? And so through that lens of the four foundations, the second foundation, the arising of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, right? So again, outside, because of the dynamic nature of experience, so much ebbing and flowing, so much pleasant, unpleasant. And so it actually invites us, forces us, asks of us, can we find a steadiness in the midst of it, both with the beautiful and the difficult and the challenging? And the third foundation, I'm just doing a very whistle-stop tour through these foundations, but we can see the nature is a wonderful vehicle to explore these, the dimension of citta, the third foundation of heart. So many beautiful qualities can be felt through the heart as we're outside. And maybe this is obvious, and maybe I'm stating the obvious, but I think it's helpful to just to reflect about these things, right? So many related qualities of heart that we cultivate through meditation, through Dharma practice. Again, I found why I shifted my practice outside most of the time. It's just more accessible. Like I sit out this morning, patio here, and just taking in the sunrise in the morning. And quite naturally, that quality of ease, of calm, of stillness comes. The sort of relaxed quality of samadhi, natural attentiveness. And that's such a beautiful counterpoint, because how often do we feel calm in our busy, angsty, stressful life? Maybe not so much. So we want to be mindful of tracking, like, what environments, what create supportive conditions for well-being. And I'm thinking of that line by Wendell Berry in one of his poems, Piece of Wild Things. He says, I go out when I'm stressed and I wake up in the middle of the night. I go outside and lie. I go outside where wild things do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I go outside and come into the presence of wild things that do not worry themselves about future catastrophes. Come into the presence of wild things who are just here. The quotes from Wendell Berry, Piece of Wild Things. I'll say the whole thing. When despair in the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives might become, I go outside and lie down where the wood drake rests his quiet beauty on the water and where the great heron feeds. I come into the presence of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come to the presence of day-blind stars waiting with their light, and for a time I rest in the grace of the world and am free. It's a beautiful invitation to go outside where things aren't stressing. Or we go outside, as I did this morning again, and that, oh, even if you live in the city, and you walk out your door and there's more space, you see sky, you see a light, you see, you know, it's just much easier to tap into another quality of our own nature, which is vastness, openness, spaciousness. It's like the spaciousness of awareness. And then within that spaciousness, the whole sensory field is coming and going. So notice how you feel when you go from your office or your whatever room you're in now, bedroom or living room, and you step outside even just to look up at the night stars or the clouds or the moon. And there's a sense of openness, spaciousness. We want to be, again, as the Buddha said, inclining our attention to that which is wholesome, that which is brightening, uplifting. In the same way, again, unlike the kind of often frazzled quality of our lives, we can sense into, at times in the natural world, silence. Silence of a morning or an evening, or stillness. One of my favorite times to meditate in the morning in nature, partly because there's a beautiful quality of stillness. I mean, the birds have started to wake up, and the light's starting to come, but there's this quality of stillness that can kind of permeate and saturate our being. And then one thing that's really important, one of many, many things in this, what I'm about to say, is as we go outside, cultivate awareness outside, that we start to open to, and I've sort of been mentioning some of them, the expansive qualities of the heart, particularly delight, joy, beauty, rapture, happiness, well-being, awe. How often in our, you know, sitting at our desk or on our social feeds or whatever, are we feeling delight? Joy, occasionally we might go on Facebook or Instagram, we see a friend and they're having a nice time with their family on holiday. And, oh, that's sweet. They're out, you know, in the mountains. They're having a birthday celebration. But I think for most of us, you know, going outside is a very easy way to tap into more expansive qualities of the heart. We happen to live on this beautiful planet. They're not all beautiful. Some of them are just rock and, you know, harsh and cold and frozen. And we live in this amazing, amazing, mysterious, fecund, wild, beautiful earth. And so there are many, many causes for joy. I often quote this poem from Jack Gilbert. I'm not going to share the whole poem because it's too long, but Marnie, if you can put it in the text, it's A Brief for the Defense by Jack Gilbert. And he's talking about the importance of joy. And he says, we can do without pleasure, but not delight. We can do without pleasure, but not delight. We must risk delight in the ruthless furnace of the world. We must risk delight in the ruthless furnace of the world. To make injustice the only measure of your attention is to praise the devil. To make injustice the only measure of your attention is to praise the devil. Which meaning, to only focus on what's wrong, on what's negative, on what's problematic, whether in yourself or others or the world. He said, why would the Bengal tiger be made so fine? Why would the house finch song be made so beautiful? Or as Robin Wall Kimmerer, a Native American Potawatomi elder here in the northeast of the US, she talks about how her elders say that the earth asks very little of us, gives us so much, but asks that we pay attention and that we offer gratitude. And we don't get to gratitude before we actually are present and to see the beauty. And just take a moment to think about what are the ways that evoke delight for you outside? What touches your heart into joy? And this is a wonderful poem by Mary Oliver, which I will probably recite in its length. And Mary Oliver, as many of you know, is a sort of this, you know, sort of quintessential nature poet, lover, mystic. And we'd go outdoors every day. We'd go out, get up, often in very cold conditions, New England, get up, walk even into our 80s. Walk for some time, by ponds, be with herons, and then come back and write poetry. She did for probably 60 years of her life. Beautiful, beautiful poet. And this poem's called Mindful, ironically, coincidentally. And she says, and just imagine her going outside, and she says, or she writes, every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world with joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, but of the ordinary, the common, drab, daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how could you help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, the oceans shine, and the prayers that are made out of grasses. So every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. So what if your day today or tomorrow had some flavor of that? And you have all of the ingredients, the tools that you need. You have a body, you have senses, and you have awareness. And we just have to incline the mind to that which brings joy or delight or beauty. I'm looking at this, I'm going to pluck one here. This is a friend of mine whose house I'm staying in. Picked this beautiful daffodil. It's very early in the season for daffodil, but you know, such as climate change. And, you know, probably where you live, you know, in a month or two or three, you'll see many, many daffodils, probably not everywhere, but. And another Mary Oliver poem, she says, contemplating death, she says, common as a field daisy and as singular. And I could say the same thing about this, common as a daffodil and as singular. And we might walk past 1,000 daffodils, yeah, daffodils, yeah, daffodils, spring. But when you actually look at a daffodil, I mean, they're just miraculous expressions of beauty. I mean, look at that. And so, so I'm going to invite you today or tomorrow, depending on where you are and whether it's light or accessible, to see what, to see or hear something that kills you with delight. Maybe not kills you, but at least evokes some delight or some joy. It may be looking at the moon rising or waning. It may be hearing the sound of a bird on your outside your window. It may be the feel of the breeze as you open the window and feel the breeze of the winter air coming in. And there's so many opportunities. And in a given the stressful times that we live in, it's essential that we also, as the poem is saying, risk delight in the ruthless furnace of the world, which means open to joy, even amidst the fire of life. And most likely when we open in that way, we also open to a whole other array of qualities of awe. You know, like I'm going to pluck this daffodil. And like, how does this daffodil arise out of the earth? Right? This dark brown mud that's full of amazing, mysterious microorganisms somehow transmutes itself into this plant and flower that reflects the sunlight. I mean, it's just wild. But when we bring awareness to that, that awareness can profoundly open us to qualities of awe, of wonder, of mystery. The fact that there's anything here at all is mysterious. The fact that it's profoundly diverse and fecund and beautiful is amazing. So I'm going to wrap up now because I want to leave some time for questions. I'm going to close with a couple lines also from Mary Oliver. And then This is a poem called Praying. She says, it doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be a few weeds in a vacant parking lot or a few small stones. Just pay attention and gather a small enough words, a few words together to make them, and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks. So I'm happy to take some time now for some questions, reflections. I haven't really been tracking the chat, but I will do now. Just a couple of things, just some logistical things. I know because and this call is normally used on Crowdcast, but switched to Dana, switched to Zoom for various logistical reasons. So I've been asked to just do a reminder about the Dana, because the Dana, Mani, you can just remind people how to offer Dana. So these teachings are always offered freely, whether it's Martin or myself or other teachers. So please, to keep these teachings alive, it's really important that we support our teachers. So please consider offering Dana for myself in this case, or whoever is teaching in other times. Yang Chen, you raised your hand and you've been looking at the birds on the feeder out your window, I noticed. You can unmute yourself, I think. Oh no, maybe I need to just, I think I didn't let you do that. Okay, now you can unmute yourself.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, sorry, first time doing this. And I have to say, I have social anxiety. So this is a really big deal for me that I'm,
well, good for you
that
for
I'm coming on
up
at all.
Yeah, congratulations.
But it speaks to how exciting of a topic this is for me that I'm actually even doing this, because it's probably the most exciting Dharma talk ever. Because I love nature, and with anxiety, I spend a lot of my time away from people and in nature. My point, I find tons of delight every day in nature. So this is all right up my alley. But my question is, you actually mentioned briefly, and I'm hoping you'll elaborate. You said, and I'm paraphrasing, something like, it can feel like cheating when you're meditating in nature. And I actually, just being a person with general guilt issues, I actually feel that way a lot. Like, I actually feel guilty sometimes that a lot of my meditation is outdoors and in nature and in my woods. Some of it's walking meditation, some of it's sitting in a little fort that I built out in my woods. You know, like, I really spend a tremendous amount of time in the woods, and I do a lot of my meditating there. And sometimes I wonder if it counts. Like, it feels completely natural and wonderful to me. But sometimes I think, well, like, I'm not on a, you know, I mean, I've been meditating for probably 30 years and it still does, like, I feel like I should be on the cushion and in a proper position doing it old school the way I was, you know, the way I learned. And I'm just wondering if you could sort of speak to meditation in nature as a valid means of meditation, you know, for those of us who grew up with a strictly Buddhist, you know, sitting in the hall, you know, perspective.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your question, Yang Chen, and I'm sure you're not the only one. I remember when I first started doing a book tour back in the days when people did book tours for Awaken the Wild, and I would, you know, be in these different bookstores around the country, and I'd ask how many people, you know, go outside, and how many people considered their time outside as part of their spiritual practice. And yet people, and there was lots of hands raised, obviously, because that was the theme of the book. But people would feel, I felt like my job was validating people's experience and practice. As the question you're holding, that we have some idea that somehow meditation and serious spiritual practice or Buddhist practice or whatever your religious faith is happens in a zendo or in a dharma hall or in a church or in a cathedral. You know, I was having a wonderful conversation with a Christian mystic who founded a beautiful school called the Church of the Wild. And she said, how is it that somehow at some point men a long time ago decided God was confined to this building with no windows and no relationship to the outside? That's weird. It's more than weird, but it's like, you know, and so her church is sitting outside like, you know, this is, you know, heaven on earth, right? Sitting in the trees in the forest or wherever you are in the meadow. And, you know, the Buddha was not sitting on a zafu. He would get a bunch of kusa grass, which is like this dense grass, and bundle it and sit, put it, you know, make a bundle like a zafu and sit on it under a tree. And nobody was asking him if his practice was, you know, authentic enough, right? It's so it's a real question, because of the way that we've become so separate from nature, and including our spiritual practice, including our meditation practice. Like I was talking to a friend who's living in a Zen center, right? A wonderful Zen center, and who's teachers that I love and teaching that I love. And she just did a session for 7 days. I said, how was it? She said, it was great, but we never, ever once went outside. I'm like, I'm not signing up for that retreat. you know, it's a fine way of practice and it's a beautiful way of practice, but as can be sitting as you're doing in the woods, in nature, with the forest, with the fells, with the lakes, wherever you are. And so, you know, and so you have to come down to the essence. Well, what is the essence of practice? It's about being awake, being aware, waking up, being embodied, being in our senses, knowing what's happening, right? All that's very alive for you, I imagine, in your nature practice outside. Probably way more alive, actually, because you're enlivened, you're sensory, you're embodied, you're connected, awareness is bright, right? There's much less sloth, much less thoughts, much less distractibility, much less restlessness, more expansiveness, right? What's not to like about that?
Well, I think that it's the fact that I like it so much is what gives me the feelings of guilt, because you're right on the money. Like I feel completely at peace and connected and awake and that joy and delight in those moments. And I think that's what makes me feel like I'm cheating a little bit. Like I for some reason feel like I'm not supposed to enjoy meditation that much.
Right. Right. Well, I think this is, I think it can be a kind of a Buddhist hangover. In that, you know, there's such a lot of emphasis on Buddhism, on suffering and the end of suffering, suffering and the resolution of suffering, that somehow we think if I'm not suffering, somehow I'm bypassing, I'm avoiding, you know, the Buddha was known as the happy one. The happy one. And it's very interesting. He wasn't just like, you know, a dukkha guy. No, he was a happy one. Like, So yes, look at the ways that we suffer and free ourselves from that. And then what remains when we're not suffering? Oh, joy, space, peace, light, beauty, love, connection, awe, wonder, mystery, right? So when that's present, saturate that, you know. Plenty of times that we will be faced with our suffering, our pain, our stress, and the suffering of life, but if nature is a doorway for the expansive qualities, enjoy those qualities. Yeah, that's your dharma in that moment.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your confirmation of what I felt in my heart all along.
Yeah, yeah, great. And then come on a nature retreat some point and get to see how you know, doing that with others is a beautiful doorway too.
I would love that. My favorite part of any retreat I've ever been on is the outdoor aspects to it. So yeah, I wouldn't go on that one you mentioned either, where there was no outdoor part. Get that.
Right. Thanks.
Thank you.
So I'm noticing a lot of conversations in the chat. Marnie's posting some links to my things. I'll talk about those just before we wrap up. Yes,
Mark, there's two questions in all of that.
Yes,
one by Sandy Levine. Uh-huh. And I'm going to scroll up to find it. And one by Jonathan M.
Uh-huh. And Jonathan M's raised their hand. But
Sandy says, how can nature be so magnificent while also posing true dangers and requiring accommodation for survival? Maybe that was more of a comment.
Yeah, that's a good question. No, I mean, you know, nature's not always like it is this morning, pastoral and sunny. I mean, we've had, you know, storms here and frigid temperatures and, you know, forest fires and, you know, and there's a lot of dimensionality with experience in nature. There's a beautiful teaching word that the Australian eco-psychologist, forget his name, McKenna, I think, this coined this term solastalgia, which is where we go out into nature and we feel not just the beauty, but we also feel the sorrow and the sadness and the loss of what's happening with what's going on ecologically. And yes, and there's also times that we feel, you know, we're a threat. You know, you're in grizzly bear country, or you're it's just the elements. You know, we have to be careful and mindful and, I've been teaching nature retreats where we've been hailed on and snowed on, and it's been freezing and bitterly cold, and that becomes practice. Also very beautiful and powerful, valid ways of practice.
Jonathan adds to that same theme, since we're on it. He says, how did Buddha reconcile the extremes of nature in his teachings, and how can nature help us understand the Four Noble Truths and inform how we walk the Eightfold Path?
Oh, please, could you not ignore the bit about the natural disaster in Europe, please?
Yes. So full thing. Watching the news, the devastation that acts of nature can create is shocking. So how did the Buddha reconcile the extremes of nature in his teaching?
Yeah, I have no idea, because I don't think I've ever come across the Buddha speaking about that. But I do know that he was very practical and pragmatic. And for example, in the rainy season, where it's torrential rains in northern India and much of Southeast Asia, they would do rains retreats where they were stationary and would probably, I imagine, meditate under shelter to protect themselves from the rain. So it's one has to be practical. And yes, nature is wild and cataclysmic and powerful, and both a bringer of beauty and destruction. And that is the Dhamma, that is the way of things. And nature is to be profoundly respected for that reason, whether it's the power of the ocean or weather or earthquakes or whatever it is. And so that's also a profound teaching. And so it thrusts us back onto, you know, there's experience and how we relate to experience. There's beauty and how we relate to beauty. There's destruction, how we relate to destruction. And so that's where mindfulness and compassion come in, is looking at how we're meeting those experiences. And just like life is both beautiful and tragic, nature is also beautiful and destructive. You know, generative and destructive. It's part of the cycles of life, and that's how life is. And so our practice is about coming into meeting that, all the dimensions of experience, of reality. Yeah, so what time for one last question from Victoria. If you'd like to unmute yourself.
Hello. Thank you, Mark. Really beautiful talk. And just before this, I came from another talk in James Barras's Awakening Joy course, led by an Israeli who's a marine biologist. And we all talked about how what awakens joy the most in life is nature. So it's a perfect segue. I there's probably isn't enough time to really delve into this question. It's one of my big questions that not through its own being, nature has galvanized in a way, I find certain communities, those who are the scientists who insist that it's just, you know, they look at everything in a totally empirical way without gratitude, without love, without joy, without all the qualities that we've talked about. That's one extreme. And then the really, like you were talking about your contemplative mystical friend, having the church in the wild, this other extreme where it's nature itself becomes the manifestation, like to quote the Hebrew scriptures, nature itself is the testament to God's existence. So that's another extreme, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered what you, how you in your work sort of handle these extremes and try to bring them into some kind of moderation. Because I think
let me cut you off there, because I'm aware of time. Yeah, that's great.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Okay.
Thanks for the question. I think, you know, we have to make room for all perspectives. And I do feel like that the scientific perspective and the mystical perspective are coming together. You know, Einstein was a great emissary of that, that his profound scientific intelligence and his understanding of the mysterious nature of the cosmos were very, very close for him. The more science reveals about how, like they just discovered how plants had this very powerful microscope on how a plant, photosynthesizing cell is releasing oxygen and inhales and exhales on a leaf or a plant or whatever. And how each plant and leaf is registering the presence or absence of CO2, and will only open when it registers a presence of CO2, because otherwise it will become dehydrated. And so the more science reveals, the more we see the mystery of life and the sacredness of life. And there's a dance between those two, and they can seem very opposite. And at times they're also, I feel like they're very much coming together. So yeah, it's a duality, and there's value to both. You know, and especially in these times where, you know, facing climate catastrophe and ecological catastrophe, what science is revealing about the beauty and the complexity and the mystery and the intrinsic interconnectedness of life is so important. So thanks, Victoria. I could say more, but I'm aware of time. We've got a minute left. Yeah. So thanks.
All right. To be continued. Thank you.
So thank you, everybody. Wonderful to be here. I do just want to give a shout out for a couple of things. Martin's a dear old friend of mine, and we've taught together for forever, and we run mindfulness teacher trainings. We've got a new one coming up in September in France. It's bilingual, English and French. It's a wonderful year-long mindfulness teacher training. And I also am bringing my Awaken the Wild work to Europe, and I'm running Awaken the Wild meditation and nature teacher training, which will be in four different countries, England, France, Spain, and Italy, starting also in September. I'm very excited about that. All that information is in the chat, or you just go to my website, markcoleman.org, and you can find out all information about that. So delightful to be with you, friends. And friends, and I can see my dearest, oldest friend, Chris Blaine and Sal there up in the Lake District. It's very heartwarming. And also just seeing many, many Dharma friends, people who've been on teacher trainings, people who've been on retreats in Europe and in the States, and including Marnie, who's been through the teacher training. And so very lovely to be with you all. And we'll just take a moment now to thank you, offering thanks for that. And we can unmute ourselves and say goodbye. So please enjoy the wild, enjoy each other, and go outside. And much love, friends.